Oh, yeah. Hi, I'm Arzamora Lindmark, and I'm the author of Rolling the R's, which I'd adapted for the stage. I also wrote Lecce, which is the 90s sequel to Rolling. And last month, I published my first book for young adults called The Importance of Being Wild at Heart. And I also wrote for poetry collections. Well, this is really important because this is the first high school that invited me during my, throughout my 25-year writing career.
Why is that important that it's the
The first
first
high
high
school.
school? Why?
Because I'm from here. I've never been invited to talk about anything. The high schools that have invited me in the mainland, what they usually do is they, because they teach my book, so they have me go and speak to her, to their students.
Which book they teach?
Surprisingly, Rolling.
Really?
In high, yeah, there's a prep school in the Bronx called Fieldston, and they're teaching Rolling, and
How do they do it? What do they act it?
because they're so smart. I was thinking in terms of the content, right? Like, wow, the racy content, the raciness of Rolling. But then I forget that nowadays the kids are and teenagers are much more, they're not as innocent or as, I think they're growing up way faster than we did. They
So,
definitely have access more to information than we did.
right. So you're saying the racy parts are not as
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 controver
shocking
yeah,
or
as shocking
controversial.
or as shocking or as an issue,
Right.
right?
But
And
I'm just amazed that they want such a deep dive into our culture.
there's huge interest in local literature, and also because of Pidgin. And to them, Pidgin is something that's a novelty and whatever, exotic if you want to go there. But they, and they're hungry. That's what I notice about the young adults and kids. Like, they're hungry for anything that can that's new or that's foreign to them.
In what way were your books new and foreign?
Well, the for example, with Rowling, the obvious is the structure, how it's presented, and the fact that this non-linear collage is called a novel. So what was interesting was how their definition of the novel genre widened because of Rowling, that they didn't know that a book could be like this, that a novel or that storytelling can come in different forms and genres.
Well, rolling the R's is such a fun way to find that out. That's all I can say.
So what I did, what I was trying to do with the importance of being wild at heart was to create the same kind of frenetic narrative structure and incorporating multiple literary genres to tell a story of a 17-year-old falling in love for the first time or discovering love for the first time. And of course, attached with love is, with first love is first heartbreak. But using the genres to the different literary genres, I have poems and lists and diary entries and essays. So it's very much like Rowling, if you think of it, except that this is, we only have one narrator. And to tell this story of this first love experience and first heartbreak. That takes place on an imaginary island in the middle of the Pacific. It's not Hawaii. Yeah, it's not. Interestingly, yes, you might think of Hawaii because I'm from here and you're from here and we know each other and but interesting the reviews that I'm getting because they're associating my fictitious island with their islands, with the place they come from. So,
like where?
Singapore. Because the north, because the island that I created is divided into two countries. So if you think of that, you think of, and it's a border story. It's a border narrative where the north, people from the north are privileged, they're entitled, they can go to the south at any time. And the people from the south can't. They have to apply for a visa. They're operating on a third world economic level. Even the third world brand of corruption in the government. And so you would think, okay, well, that's not Hawaii really, because Hawaii might be the north. It's in what is the south, right? And so the guy who reviewed the book, who's from Singapore, said this is very much like Singapore, Malaysia. And because of the north, in the north, in my fictitious island, there's a military, they have to go to mandatory military service after high school. And so he attached that to Singapore. Another one said, oh, it sounded like Puerto Rico, Guam even. You know, on my way here from Manila, I stopped over in Guam. And the airport was flooded with army soldiers in their fatigues at 4:30 a.m., as in the entire three boarding gates were just soldiers. And I just said, oh, there's my island right there, my fictitious island. So I think anyone who's ever been from a place that's either heavily colonized or militarized can relate to this fictitious island that I created. And I also didn't want to create another, I didn't want to set in Hawaii where the novel would be placed against the, would be judged based on authenticity or factual. I wanted to really engage the reader's imagination.
Is the protagonist Filipino?
No. No, it's, he's definitely part Japanese, because the mother's Japanese, from Japan, and we don't know who the father is. So he could be part Filipino. I don't disclose that information. I don't know, because I don't know. And I'm not interested in the father's ethnicity or race. It's so different from, I know you're looking at me like, oh God, this is new.
He's explaining this in a very sober way. And yet I feel when I open the cover of the book, all this stuff's going to leap out and a lot of it's going to be hilarious.
Not this one. I don't know if it's hilarious. I think it's sophisticated and cute. It has that element, that young adult element, because they're kids of color or teenagers, people of color. And they're 17-year-old, they're about to graduate. And they're so different from each other, but they're all marginalized for whatever reason.
Why are you writing about that? Are people like that?
Because I'm interested in how a community is formed. You know, that, and I wanted to explore the birth of a community. And so in this case, we have Kenzie, who's half Japanese, half unknown. We have his friend who's an indigenous person from the Pula tribe, and she's a transgender. Then we have Estelle, who's androgynous and is a threat to both the male and female sex because they can't make sense of her because she's so gender fluid. Then we have a born-again jock, Christian jock. And we have like a prom queen, a cheerleader at the bottom of a pyramid. And they're common. And so they're all marginalized for those reasons.
So how do communities form?
They have a common, their common denominator here is Oscar Wilde, is their attraction or fascination with Oscar Wilde's character Dorian Gray. And so they form a book club. So a community can start, a book club can start off as a community. Or a community can start off as a book club, rather. Yeah.
I see.
So, and then they have a teacher, a book club advisor who's from Nigeria. And he's counseling them about Oscar Wilde's life. And so they're, I'm also interested in how a first world figure or a historical figure like Oscar Wilde gets translated by a person of color, by a young person of color.
Today.
Today.
That's a good question.
And I think that here you have obvious connections with Oscar Wilde, his flair for dandyism. You know, he loves to dress up. The whole concept art of bunburying, which is going to a place and pretending to be somebody else. And that's a very young adult concept. And so I took that bunburying concept of Wilde and I gave it a twist in this novel. So they go to places where, for example, they go to a mall, an upscale mall in the east portion of the island, where they are usually discriminated against, but they dress up and they're using bunburying as a way of passing, if they can pass.
Huh.
Because it really is about first love and first heartbreak. That's the gist of the novel. And it's chronicling the experience of this 17-year-old who's experiencing love for the first time and seeing it evolve or devolve to heartbreak and the recovery after heartbreak. Like, what do you do after you throw your heart away because it's been trashed? So that, and then the other things that we were talking about, that's like the setting, the atmosphere, the political atmosphere, social atmosphere, and the border atmosphere. That's all part of the setting.
Mm-hmm.
And but what at the core of this is this 17-year-old kid who loves to make lists and writes haikus and really prefers to be by himself. And that's okay. Like, being a loner in his case is okay. And there's not that craving to belong. Because I also wanted to explore the whole thing about belonging. Like, who is it for? Who is belonging for? Like, are we trying to fit in? And what is lost when we're trying to fit in to be accepted? Do we lose our identity there along the way? Do we give up our identity so we can be accepted?
Yeah,
is that the only way? You know what I mean? So that's, you said, yeah, so I guess so. I mean, like,
I don't know. It burst out of me.
Yeah.
Belonging, I mean, that's very much from the 17-year-old lexicon. I mean, was it hard for you to, I mean, maybe we still feel that, everybody still feels and wonders that. Yeah.
Well, what I try to do here is, do we need the populace, or do we have to be accepted by the majority? And if it means losing our identity or giving up who we are just to be accepted, is it even worth that journey, that sacrifice? What if we find within this dominant community a sub-community comprised of three or four people with a common denominator here in this case called Oscar Wilde, and It's a smaller community, obviously, but with people who accept you and are able to talk to you about your differences. You know, isn't that more productive in the long run rather than, you know, trying to
conform to every,
you know? And I think that this is why, you know, the novel, the idea to write a book for young adults, I was never interested in that. I don't write for a targeted audience. But in 2010, after I wrote Lecce and handed the final draft of Lecce to my editor and was supposed to take a break, right, I decided to read the biography of Oscar Wilde by Richard Ellman, right? So, and because I've always been fascinated by Oscar Wilde since the 80s, mm-hmm. when I found out that he wrote. He was this fantastic playwright, but also he was, at that time, you know, what you would call, what we would identify as gay, even though the word didn't exist back then, right? And so that, and he was very controversial and scandalous, and so that appealed to me. So I wanted to read more about that part of his life and what happened, right? What really happened. And at the same time that I was reading his biography, these, I don't know if you remember this, but all these teenagers were committing suicide in the U.S. And there were like four young men as young as 12 up to maybe a freshman in Rutgers. Mm. This was September 2010, I think. September. And two of those, the two younger ones hung themselves. And one of them survived, but and hung on to this world for 10 or 12 days. Mm. You know, and it was that moment where I was reading about Oscar Wilde and how he was publicly lynched, basically, by the very same people, the upper class, who celebrated his brilliance and his genius and his wit and his, you know, plays and essays. And so it felt like I was talking to, I was, there was this dialogue going on between the book I was reading, the biography of Ellman, and this tragedy of these kids and young adults that were offing themselves, you know. And I said, I don't know, it reminded me of growing up in the 80s and what people like kids like them and young adults like them had to go through with the AIDS virus and being discriminated and even kicked out of their towns because of their sexuality, because they were associated with that disease, because the government refused to acknowledge the fact that it wasn't just killing a small sector of the society, but it's gone on to infect everyone else, you know. And that kind of, and the bullying that happened in school, especially with the Ryan White case. And then there was one here also in Hawaii. I think he was a hemophiliac, a kid, and I think he went to Hickam Air Force, elementary school there. The same thing. So there I was. It was like, okay, well, then there was this urgency. Like I had to write a book about this, about, I felt it was my responsibility as a writer. And I never had this kind of responsibility, this gravity until then, you know. And
to write about what?
To write about bullying, to write about kids that are, to write a book that young adults can access, right? Because I've written kids, books with kids and young adults in them, but they were not for, they were for mature, I want to put that in quote, mature audience, right? Mature readers. I wanted to write one that would be specifically accessible to young adults.
How'd you do that?
It took me 7 years.
Yeah, well, how'd you do it?
I don't know.
What makes you think it'll work?
Well, that's the risk. And I'm all for risk.
Is it different from your other novels?
I think the language is different. The tone, it's restraint. So I would be very curious to see what you think of it. It's not loud.
It sounds much more interior than
It's very interior. Things. It's very this is introspective. It's very introspective.
This is different in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's almost, it has the same frenetic structure of Rowling, but it's a very quiet book. It's fun, but it's not loud. It's not a party fiesta. It's a very introspective, and because Kenzie is a very introverted character, he lives in a world where his main desire when he grows old is to retire in Antarctica. I mean, so, you know, because it's a world where the only war that exists is the war for survival. It's, you don't have people killing each other.
I know, you know? But what about this? I mean, what he wants to do when he grows up is such a Japanese-y thing. And he's a part Japanese guy. I mean, is there anything Filipino about this book?
No, I don't know. That's interesting. Because I wasn't racially labeling my characters the way I was doing with enrolling. You know, I was more interested, again, I was more interested in love, if that makes sense. The love of...
Wait, and, are you qualified to...
Yes, I am very qualified. Okay. I think so, wait. So, okay, so let me tell you the love that I deal with here. Okay. The love, because it's a book of love of sorts, right? Mm. There's the romantic love, right? So which is followed by your first heartbreak. Then there's the love among friends, right? Between friends. Then there's the love between, the unspoken, quiet love between a mother and her son. Then there is the love for a place, however damaged that place is. So I think I qualify for, and then there's, yeah, so I think I qualify for maybe 3.5 of
that. Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now it's different. It's got haikus. It's got... You want me to read
a portion? Would you?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll read.
So much fun. Thanks so much.
No, thank you. God, I haven't done, you know, this... I haven't done anything in here for a while. Okay, wait. So just to give you a sense, let me read the first 6 pages of the novel. It will only take like less than a minute, right? So if you there are 2 ways to begin this story. A haiku, Little Miracles. Inside a minute, a blue-throated hummingbird's 1,000 heartbeats, or a prayer. Dear Oscar Wilde, patron saint of rebels and bookworms, this is Kenzie. I'm 17 years old, a senior at South Crystal High. I live on an island in the middle of nowhere Pacific Ocean. So tiny, you need a magnifying glass to spot us on the map. Oscar, I met someone. There, it's out. Woo, yes. I met someone earlier this week, and this morning I woke up to my heart beating 1,000 hummingbird heartbeats. It felt new and strange, and anything new and strange to me is worth exploring, like Antarctica. I don't know where my heart is zooming to. So if you could, please guide me through this unfamiliar map. Your forever devotee, Kenzie. P.S. Oh, yeah. His name is Ran.
Whoa, okay.
Okay, I'll read another one.
That's cool. It is. I like it. I really want to know more.
Okay. Do you want to... You want me to read you a heartbreak
or
yeah? Okay. You want me to read you a heartbreak poem or a mother-son poem?
Let's see. Heartbreak.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that. All right. Let's go. Wait. I think you can remember this. You probably know who I'm stealing the first line from. Tonight, I can write the saddest us. Hmm. Neruda.
Oh, really?
Tonight, I can write the saddest lines.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Is it the saddest lines? Yeah. So, Kenzie's a poet. So, he reads a lot of poetry. And he reads Dickinson and William Carlos Williams and Neruda. And a lot of haikus, Basho. And so he appropriates these poems. And so this is an appropriation of, well, this is an emulation of Neruda.
Oh, that's so wonderful. I'm so sad I don't know that poem. Okay. I'll find it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Tonight I can write the saddest us. To think once under a giant moon, you draped your arm across my shoulders. It was so surreal I could not move. Gladly stuck between flight and surrender. From you I learned a random kind of happiness. From you I found another meaning to me. Yet tonight, when the blur in my world no longer thrills me, I go to bed with you, tossing and turning in my thoughts. My only wish to unlearn the kiss and the craving that comes with it. To see you one last time is all I'm asking for, so I can ask Ran, was I ever a part in your moments of happiness too? Tonight I can write the saddest us. In the book of love, I liked you, and I think you liked me too. Inside our small universe where a billion kinds of loneliness now reside. A mislaid word is how I feel tonight. You taught me comfort, Ran, but forgot the part about my heart and how to stop it from unraveling. Doubt is a certainty tonight while your absence ransacks this room. Tonight, I can write the saddest us. Tonight, I can write the saddest us.
Oh, that's kind of wonderful. Sorry to make such a sad sound there.
But you know, I had to read a lot of young adult books. And I noticed they're all dark. Many of them are dark and twisted. And so maybe that's why they, you know, when they got hold of Rowling, it was nothing.
Well, I mean, your people could read your things and get their minds blown for the sexuality, for the, you know, for the ethnicity part of it, as well as for the simple form of it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting to know what they were going for.
Yeah. And I think that this is, you know, this is probably why this might come as a surprise. I don't know. Because it's really toned down. I mean, I am working on a sequel to Rowling, and that is highly amplified.
And what's with this alleged poetry collection then?
Oh, okay. So last year, or no, 2 years ago, we celebrated the 20th anniversary of Rowling. And I published, my poetry publisher, Hanging Loose Press, published my fourth poetry collection called Pop Verite. Oh, and that's very pop. I mean, and I use, and it's set in Paris, because most of all my poetry collections are specifically set in one or two places or one or two cities. So the second one was Tokyo, because I lived in Tokyo. And the first one is Honolulu, Manila. The second is Tokyo. The third, Spain.
Really?
Spain. And then the fourth one is Paris. So there's a lot of poems about Paris.
Oh, how wonderful. That's that would have been a fun project to research.
Oh, yeah. And also reading a lot of, because a lot of these French contemporary poets, like the Oulipo movement, where they do a lot of experimental writings, they're a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I love being in Paris. And so I wrote most of them while I was in Paris.
Do you read a lot? Do you take your books with you and read at these internationally or nationally?
You mean like read my own book?
Yeah.
Like I don't do readings. No, but unless I have a book.
A new one?
A new one, yeah.
I mean, because, you know, the formal aspects of your work are not as much a surprise now as they were when, you know, Rolling the Arts first came out. I really wonder, across America with its, you know, that's going through this, like, a bit of a racial paroxysm right now, how are people receiving your work?
Well, when I sent out letters to professors for this new book, letter of solicitation, to asking them if they want to have me talk to their students, the response was so favorable that I'm going on a 8.5-week book tour. It's like a 10-week book tour.
Mm-hmm. Where?
I start here in Punahou. I'm the writer in residence. And then we're launching the book. There's going to be a book signing, not a reading, but a book signing in Ideas. But the Punahou event apparently is open to the public.
Exactly. That's why I'm talking with you
And that's supported by the Ruth Goodsill Writing Fund. And I'm also visiting classrooms, students, classes that teach gender and diversity and American Lit and creative writing classes. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to that. So I start here, and then I go to New York, and then I do D.C. I do several Ivy League schools like Dartmouth, Harvard, Columbia, Cornell. And we're launching the novel in New York at the Asian American Writers Workshop, which is co-sponsored by NYU. Then I'm doing West Coast as well. A lot in San Francisco, like Berkeley, UC Santa Cruz, University of San Francisco, the International Philippine Book Fair, UC Davis.
Why do you think they're interested?
I think because of the way it's challenging the definition of a conventional novel. That's one. And second, I think it's because it's so in your face. You mean Rowling?
I don't know. They still have Rowling in their minds when they invite you.
And Lecce.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think they're curious as to what my next book is going to be. And I think that's why they invited me. And then I think I also, the issues I deal with in my novels are so relevant to now, even if it takes place on a fictitious island or it's about gender or race, racial encounters or...
What do you ultimately say about belonging?
Well, if it means giving up who you are and what you stand for to be accepted, it's not worth it. You can't love yourself if you're gonna give that part up. Mm. And if it means giving that up so you can be accepted, it's not really worth the sacrifice. You know, I think that there's a line in here that's belonging is overrated in this new novel. And I think that once we find that we can form a community as early as high school age.
And you think that is what helps us to remain ourselves despite the pressures of...
Yes. And I think that, you know, I used to think that it's so much easier for kids and for young adults to come out and to deal with their gender and their sexuality. But they're different, they're dealing with a different kind of oppression.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, there's cyberbullying. I mean, there's, we didn't have that growing up. We didn't have the internet world.
We had the face-to-face.
We had the face-to-face. We had the name-calling. Yes. And so which you would think would be more terrifying, right? But cyber mob is just as terrifying, you know? I mean, a lot of these kids who committed suicide was precisely because they were cyber-bullied. I mean, it's fascinating how this multiple unknown kind of big brotherly atmosphere of violence can push someone to that extent, to that edge of, you know, self-infliction, you know, violence. It's interesting, you know. And I think that really you can't, it is, that's how you can form, once you've established that community of, you know, in this case it was a book club, it's a book club. Once you've established that, I think it makes it easier for discussion, for discourse, like not just intellectual, but for the mind to be more embracive of what it was fearful of. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because all our guards are down, and once we reveal who we are, I mean, and accept who we are, it makes it easier for others to do the same, and to have a back and forth. You know, I mean, these kids are different. I mean, they're very different from each other, and yet they're able to discuss their differences without escalating into violence or, you know, but they also protect each other. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I love like this show called Pose. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's about the voguing in the 1980s, 1990s, where each house is run by a transgender mother. Mm-hmm. And she takes in all these runaways and cares for them, and you know, and that's in that house is a solid community.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because I think the community that we tend to think of is like the Kalihi community. No, I'm talking about the very, very basic, you know, 2-3 man, 4 man, the kind of like school clubs, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That's a community.
Yeah.
It becomes a community when you're able to discuss not just you're able to be yourself and not be afraid and not hate yourself because you're surrounded by other people who are not like you. Do you know what I mean?
I do, and I wonder, is that how you did it? I mean, how did you become comfortable with who you are?
I did the same thing. I hung out with friends. They were in high school, you mean?
No, till now.
I don't care. I don't care about what other people think. That's the other thing too. Why should I care what people think? I mean, like, I'm not gonna privilege that over what I think of myself.
That's the...
How can you love yourself if you're going to be so concerned about what they think of you?
Yeah, that's a question.
I mean, if you're going to dictate your life based on their opinion of you, wow, that's tragic. That's tragic. That's why these kids, even though, you know, they knew who they were. And their parents accepted them, but then there is this other world called internet and classroom and shopping mall that may not be as receptive of them as their own parents. But to come out and say at age 10 that this is who I am, this is what I desire, this is who I desire, that takes a lot of guts. And guts I wish I had when I was 10. Maybe that's why I wrote Rolling. I wish I was those kids. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Those kids with guts that said, I don't care what you think of me.
Mm. We all wish that.
Right? So why not write a book with that attitude? I mean, Oscar Wilde, after all, had that attitude.
He paid for it.
And he paid for it, yes. And even after he paid for it, it's sad, you know, but he still managed to forgive. You know, and if there's another side to this book, it is about forgiveness. How do you forgive yourself for loving someone and getting hurt, knowing that maybe the relationship wasn't going to work out? We're always doing it. We're doing it now. I mean, you know,
yeah.
And forgiveness is a very hard thing. And, you know, and the last third of the book is about forgiveness. Oh. You know, and so it taught me a lot about myself, I think, and my craft, and that forgiveness is a process, and love is a process. It doesn't come to you in this neatly packaged box, and you know, it's you go through it like a journey, and I recently discovered that forgiveness is similar to love in the sense that it is a ongoing thing. It is a process, you know. Deep thoughts with Noi.
It's fun.
I didn't think you were expecting this. You were expecting explosion.
Yeah, this is the start of your book tour. Expect the same at every damn stop. It's gonna be just like, but yeah. You know, would you introduce yourself?
Oh yeah, hi, I'm R. Zamora Lindmark, and I'm the author of Rolling the R's, which I'd adapted for the stage. I also wrote Leche, which is the 90s sequel to Rolling, and last month, I published my first book for young adults called The Importance of Being Wild at Heart. And I also wrote for poetry collections. Mm-hmm. And I currently live here in Honolulu and in Baguio, Philippines.
Baguio. What's that like?
It's like cool, not as toxic as Manila, manageable. I live beside a mountain, so I have a view of the only remaining forests. It's beautiful and quiet, and it's like my own residency. So I really go there to write. I don't have time for socializing, you know. And I go to Manila maybe once a month, you know, usually to get out of the country.
Have characteristics of Filipinos changed?
What do you mean?
I don't know. You've sort of, yeah, just that.
You mean like characteristics?
Yeah, I don't know how to say. I mean, you just painted them with such bright colors in the past, and I just wonder if you would paint them the same way now, or whether maybe people have changed, the country's changed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the thing about Manila, for example, let's just talk about Manila, is that it's a country, it's a city that's undergoing, it's constantly undergoing like a makeover, not necessarily for the good. And when I was working on Leche, I lived in that city, and it was feeding me because it was teaching me about what I was writing about. And so it was like a 12-year relationship with that book. And it was not always a honeymoon. It was a marriage made in heaven and hell. You know, it was a relationship. And once I was done with that book, the living conditions had worsened since then. And it was just so difficult for me to get around. And I don't have a car. You know, I live in a condo. I live in the middle of the financial district. And to get out, it takes me like an hour or so just to get to the next town. So from here, for example, to Kalihi would take me an hour.
Wow.
Right? It would take me an hour. And that's already fast. So, and it's a noise magnet city. And noise is not something that I want to work with when I'm working on a novel. So especially a quiet one like this one. But with Lecce, it was fine because it was complementing the chaos in the novel. It was complementing the noise volume, you know, the amplified noise and even what the characters were, what the main character Vince was going through, you know, trying to navigate his way inside this maze called Manila. No, I'm not interested in that. Wrote the book, lived it. Not lived his life, but lived the process of writing
right.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not in. I've moved on. I'm. You know, I don't want to write another book like that. I don't want to repeat myself.
Do you have something in the oven for after?
This one, I'm working on the sequel to Rolling.
They're older now.
No, this one is in the 80s. So yeah, they're older. They're like sophomore at Farrington. Oh yeah.
I can't wait.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's if they think Rolling. Is Rolling is safe, and I don't like safety.
So glad to hear that.
Yeah, I don't. I believe in safety, protecting each other, but in my writing, I don't believe in safety. And that's the risk, and you get blasted for it. Well, that's not my issue. That's not my problem. You know, and that's the one, if there is one lesson that I learned from my mentor, Fake Ignaswe, it was that. Never write with a safety net.
What do you mean?
Meaning, you know, don't, if you're, just go take the risk. There's nothing to lose, you know. If you
Sometimes you don't know if this is great or bad.
Exactly. You know, and I would rather have a spectacular failure, because if taking that great risk and having that spectacular failure is much more preferred to me than playing it safe, knowing that I could have done something else, knowing that I could have taken it further. You know, and so, because I don't write for. I never write to please. I don't know if I can do that, but I don't. I'm all about trying to broaden this definition called the novel. You know, I mean, if I studied literature in college, so if you think of the early novels, they were written in different forms. Like the first English novel is supposedly Richardson's, I think, Pamela or Clarissa, and it's epistolary. But if you want to take it like a couple centuries before that, I think the first novel really is Thomas More's Utopia, right? And it's dystopic. That's like the great 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 grandfather of dystopic fiction, right?
Yeah,
but like
good place to start.
Yeah, and then if you talk about like Murasaki, Genji,
oh, yeah.
I mean that's a novel about customs and being a courtesan. Pillow Book is a book of lists.
That wasn't that long ago, though, really.
Yeah, and then even Cervantes. I mean, like. But see, these are all like Rabelais novel. I mean, these are all experimental novels. So now I don't know, like, how did we get stuck on this conventional way of reading and thinking about the novel? So that when you have a book like Lecce or Rowling or something else, like Dog Eaters, for example, by Hagedorn, or Karinte Yamashita's novels are very experimental.
Well, Diaz, I mean...
Junot Diaz, yeah. I mean, these are all trying to broaden, if not challenge, the conventional way of thinking and reading the novel. And I think that that is where I'm coming from as a practitioner, you know. I would love to write a conventional novel. Maybe one of these days I will write one with a straight-through narrative where you don't have all these literary forms. Right now, I don't want to do that, you know, because there are writers doing it already, and they're doing it way better, and they're very good at it. But that's not my interest as a writer. I'm not interested in writing a conventional, traditional way, you know. I'm more interested in how all these different genres relate or work with each other in telling this story and in building this big world. That's my interest.
Thanks so much, Seth.
No, thank you. Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
And I would be very curious to think what to know what you think of this new one. It's very Japanese in aesthetic.